From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a novel about incest from a writer who says she hates the whole literature of victimology and considers many books on incest pseudo-porn. We'll talk with writer Dorothy Allison. Also today, viruses, how and why new ones emerge. We talk with Robin Morantz Hennig. Her new book is about research on the viral frontier. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the hip-hop group Diggable Planets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A second man was arraigned in New York today in connection with last Friday's bombing at the World Trade Center. Ibrahim Elga Brownie was charged with obstructing justice, but authorities said he may have played a role in the bombing itself. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Elga Brownie was arrested yesterday after he allegedly assaulted two federal agents who had come to search his Brooklyn apartment. Police said they found pistols in the apartment and fraudulent passports in his clothing. Authorities went to the apartment because it was listed on a rental form for the van allegedly used in the bombing. The FBI yesterday arrested the man who had rented the van, 25-year-old Mohammed Salamah. They said they found tools and equipment for making a bomb inside the New Jersey apartment where Salamah was staying. Federal officials told NPR today they believe Salamah made the bomb that exploded at the World Trade Center, but was not the strategist behind the bomb plot. Authorities say the search continues for other suspects in the case. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The Justice Department now says that the arrests of three men today at a mosque in Brooklyn were not connected with last week's bombing. An FBI spokesman initially said the arrests were related, but the Justice Department says that's not true. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn, issued a warning to his congressional colleagues today not to look to the defense budget for further cuts. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president has proposed cuts from defense spending totaling $123 billion over 5 years. In a speech on the Senate floor this morning, Nunn said the Defense Department is in the midst of a massive build-down that began with the 1990 budget agreement with the Bush administration. Nunn said he would work to ensure Congress sticks to whatever number is agreed on by the Budget Committee for defense spending.
And I strongly believe that the final defense number in the budget resolution, whatever it is, must be not only a ceiling, but also a floor, and I will be fighting for that view.
Nunn said the defense budget should be protected from further cuts if projections for inflation and the effect of the proposed fuel tax prove inaccurate. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
A human rights group charged today that the United States and the UN have given undue legitimacy to leaders of some of the rival factions in Somalia. The group, Africa Watch, generally praised the U.S.-led military intervention in Somalia. At the same time, though, the Africa Watch report said the United States and the UN have accepted thugs and criminals as legitimate leaders and given them a place in peace negotiations. The group urged that the negotiations be broadened to include representatives of what's left of Somali civil society. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 5 points today to close at 3,404. This is NPR. Germany's central bank cut a key interest rate today, setting off a wave of optimism in European stock markets. The Bundesbank cut its money market interest rate almost a quarter point to 8.25%. The London Stock Exchange hit a record high on the news, partly in the belief that British interest rates may also be cut. The leader of a Texas religious cult has assured authorities that he will not take his own life or those of his followers in the way Jim Jones did with 900 devotees in Guyana in 1978. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Anxiety has been rising that Branch Davidian leader David Koresh would follow his own apocalyptic teachings and order a mass suicide among his 110 followers. Former members of the sect said there had been talk of this in the past. One pointed out ominously that of the 21 children Koresh has released so far, not one has been his own child. That heightened fears that Koresh might be planning to sacrifice his children along with himself. The FBI announced today, however, that Koresh flatly denied planning to make martyrs of himself or his followers. In another development, negotiators sent medical supplies into the compound so Koresh could have a wound on his wrist sutured. Koresh earlier said he was shot in the stomach during Sunday's gun battle. Noticing his energetic behavior in recent days, one FBI agent said dryly that Koresh had undergone a miraculous recovery. I'm John Burnett reporting.
The nation's unemployment rate continued to edge downward in February, and jobs grew by their biggest number since early 1989. The Labor Department said the unemployment rate dropped by a tenth of a point to 7%, while non-farm payrolls expanded by 365,000 jobs. That was better than many analysts had expected, but Labor Secretary Robert Reich cautioned it's still too early to celebrate. He said the nation is still 3 million jobs behind where it should be. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dorothy Allison has written a new novel about a girl who is sexually abused by her stepfather. Yet Allison has said that she hates most of the books on incest and considers many of them to be pseudo-porn. When I asked what makes her think people use books about incest as a turn-on, she told me because her stepfather used to keep a pile of them under his bed. This stepfather abused Allison throughout her childhood. Her novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, is about violence and incest in a poor Southern family. Last year it was nominated for a National Book Award. It's just come out in paperback. Our interview was recorded last September. Allison says she has tried to avoid the pitfalls of the literature of victimology by being as honest as possible. But being honest means describing the disturbing, confusing thoughts of the victim. You'll get a sense of that from this reading a third of the way into the book.
It's essentially about the point where she's old enough and things have progressed enough that the abuse has become unavoidable. I didn't daydream about fire anymore. Now I imagine people watching while Daddy Glenn beat me, though only when it was not happening. When he beat me, I screamed and kicked and cried like the baby I was. But sometimes, when I was safe and alone, I would imagine the ones who watched. Someone had to watch. Some girl I admired who barely knew I existed. Some girl from church or down the street, or one of my cousins, or even somebody I'd seen on TV. Sometimes a whole gang of them would have to be trapped into watching. They couldn't help me. They couldn't get away. They had to watch. In my imagination, I was proud and defiant. I'd stare back at him with my teeth set, making no sound at all, no shameful scream, no begging. And those people who watched admired me and hated him. I pictured it that way, and I put my hands between my legs. It was scary, but it was thrilling, too. Those who watched me loved me. It was as if I was being beaten for them, and I was wonderful in their eyes.
You understand this fantasy of having people watch you and admire you as you're beaten but remain defiant?
Yes. It's curious because it's what I did as a child, and I've talked to other survivors, and it's one of the ways in which you can fight the feeling of being this contemptible being. Because basically when you're subjected to that kind of abuse as a child, you almost always begin to feel that it's justified, that there is really something wrong with you, that you're this terrible person that this is happening to. And the only way I ever found really to deal with the emotional onslaught of those feelings was to begin to feel like a martyr, this almost Joan of Arc figure in my own mind.
Something that really upsets the girl in this story, she hates the beatings, she hates the incest, she hates her stepfather. But she's turned on by the stories she tells herself about the beatings.
Yes.
And masturbates to those stories that she makes up. And she feels terribly guilty about this.
Absolutely.
And she thinks that maybe she's as guilty as her stepfather is.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you understand, too?
Oh, yes. And it's hard to explain to people on the outside of the experience, mostly because it's really hard to admit that you could take that experience and convert it into your own erotic charge. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to analyze it. I simply know that it happens and it becomes a way to make it your own experience.
I think one of the reasons why someone might be reluctant to admit to a feeling like that is not only their own kind of fear at what they were feeling, but also the fear that somebody would say, well, see, that must have meant she enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's like the myth of rape, you know. Obviously, if you orgasm during rape, then it must not have been rape. So if a child begins to feel erotic excitement while being manipulated by an adult, does that give the adult permission to do it? It's a horrible thing to even imagine. And you don't, part of the reason to keep it a secret and to be quiet about that feeling is that you might give someone any small measure of encouragement to feel they have a right to do this. They have no right ever to sexually touch a child. It's just not possible to do. There's no justification for it. And the fact that the child might, in fact, manufacture some erotic excitement is not a justification for it. But if we pretend that it doesn't happen, then that guilt, that self-horror stays, never goes away.
When you hear about somebody having experienced sexual pleasure while they were being victimized.
Well, what upsets me is that they're then ashamed of themselves for it.
Uh-huh.
That I find upsetting. We don't have, especially if you're a child, I mean... My incest started when I was 5 years old. I wasn't capable of making any decision about what I wanted to do. I didn't have the capacity to do that. When I began to feel all these funny feelings that I could not explain to myself, all I experienced was horror. I began to think that I was the terrible person I was being told I was. And it's taken me most of my life to make the decision that that's not the case.
Did you punish yourself when you were young for feelings that you thought you shouldn't have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think there's any way that that does not happen. Because you can, you feel like that the worst thing you do is if you don't automatically just hate and abhor everything. Especially if it becomes a trade-off, you know, like, all right, if this day he doesn't hit you and you something else happens and you start thinking, well, that wasn't so bad. Then your guilt becomes enormous. I think that's where some of the most excruciating damage is. That's where it takes place.
In the self-punishment.
Yeah. And in this concept of yourself as this horrible, sick person. You begin to feel like it's your fault. And the worst thing is that you begin to feel like the perpetrator is your victim. And that's, of course, something that the perpetrator always encourages.
That the perpetrator is your victim. Would you explain that?
Well... I can't talk for lots of other people. My experience was my perpetrator always was saying, I just can't help myself, you know, it's just you, it's just you. And you tell a child that often enough and they'll begin to believe you.
There's something very flattering in that too, isn't there?
Well, it's a kind of backwards flattering if what they're doing is something that horrifies you.
Right, right.
But the attention can be flattering.
That's what I meant. Yeah, that's what I meant by somebody that's telling you basically that you're special.
Yeah.
You know?
And you're engaged in this enormous drama.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing that I don't think people talk enough about. That can be very exciting in a way. You know, every day is a new piece of the drama. Now, every night is a horror because you're going back into this absolute pit of shame. Self-contempt.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Dorothy Allison. She's written a new novel called Bastard Out of Carolina. Would you tell us the story your relatives told you about how you were born?
I was born in a car accident. My mother was on the way to the airport with a bunch of my uncles and aunts, and they hit another car, and she was in the back seat asleep, so she was thrown over the front seat, through the windshield, over the other car. She wasn't hurt too bad, except that she had a concussion and was unconscious for 3 days, and of course I was born while she was unconscious, which meant that my grandmother and my aunts were at the hospital, and they got into an argument while talking to the clerk and didn't manage to manufacture the manufactured marriage my mother had been going to get through. So I became a certified bastard.
How old was she when she gave birth to you?
15. 1 month past her 15th birthday. She was a child.
How old was she when she married? She did eventually marry, right?
My mother married 3 times. Well, the first marriage was annulled. But she married my stepfather when I was 5 and lived with him until she died.
And he was the man who abused you when you were growing up?
Yes.
Did she know about it?
Yes and no. One of the things that's hard to explain to people is that my mother knew because there were... I told her. Actually, I didn't tell her. I told one of my cousins who told her. But it's very hard. What's hard to explain is that she did not let herself know all of everything that was happening. She couldn't have. And when I grew up and I would go home and talk to her, we would have these very long, slow, painful conversations. And she was enormously guilty that she had not been able to stop it. And she tried. That's one of the hard things that I try to show in the book is, like my mother, Annie in the book, tries desperately to prevent what she sees happening, even though she doesn't see a lot of what's going on. And she tries to protect her children. She believes absolutely that the man she loves is going to change, that what's happening is just because he can't find a job, because his father is mean to him, because he's hurt and wounded, that he's just... She thinks of him as this little boy that she's going to mother into being a good man. And she cannot believe that that's not happening.
So you must have been very angry with your mother for staying with your stepfather after she knew for certain what was happening to you.
Not until I was in my 30s did I really start to get angry at her in that way. My mother loved me. My mother spent her whole life desperately trying to make my life and the lives of my sisters better. She literally worked herself to death, taking care of us, trying to make some small difference. And if you had ever had a way to meet her, you would have met someone that was just extraordinarily loving and a very large-souled human being. And I was madly in love with my mother. And I knew how impossible her life was. She worked as a waitress her whole life. The best job she ever had was as a cook. She was constantly sick. There was enormous bills. She never, never got her life under control. And she always thought if she just worked a little harder, did this little thing more, it would be possible. That having her there, having her like this barrier between me and what was essentially a really cruel world, I loved her enormously. I could not possibly have been angry at her while I was at home. And for a long time after, she was my heroine. It was only when I began to really deal with the problems in my own life that had resulted as being... That getting out of being the victim and into being a survivor was when I started to get angry. And it was nightmarish. To be angry at her that way.
What kind of terms were you on when she died?
I went, the month before my mother died was the first time in 20 years that I stayed in her home. Up to that point, I had always, when I got money together, I'd send her a plane ticket and have her come visit me. I did not go home. I refused to stay in my stepfather's house once I was an adult. But that last... I was there 2 weeks in the month before she died, and I left. When the day I left, she told me it was the best 2 weeks of her life because it was one of the last chances we had to really talk. And she had finally stopped being so guilty, and we could really just be with each other and love each other.
She was still living with your stepfather then?
Yes.
So he's still alive?
Oh, yes.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about your writing and about your life. My guest is Dorothy Allison, and her new novel is called Bastard Out of Carolina. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Dorothy Allison is my guest. Her new novel is called Bastard Out of Carolina. But, Dorothy, I'm going to ask you to read something from the preface to a collection of short stories that came out a few years ago. And the collection of short stories is called Trash. Would you read the opening of the preface for us? It's titled Deciding to Live.
I became the one who got away, who got glasses from the Lions Club, a job from Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, and finally went to college on a scholarship. There I met the people I had always read about, girls whose fathers loved them innocently, boys who drove cars they had not stolen, whole armies of the middle and upper classes I had not truly believed to be real, the children to whom I could not help but compare myself. I matched their innocence, their confidence, their capacity to trust, to love, to be generous against the bitterness, the rage, the pure and terrible hatred that had consumed me. And like so many others who had gone before me, I began to dream longingly of my own death. I began to court it, cowardly, traditionally, that is, in the tradition of all those who had gone before me, through drugs and drinking and stubbornly putting myself in the way of other people's violence. Even now, I cannot believe how it was that everything I survived became one more reason to want to die.
Why do you think you went through a self-destructive period after having decided to live and getting away from home?
Oh, dear, it's like math. It's like one and one. You take a child and rob that child of all self-esteem, you will get an adult that has no sense of their own worth. I spent a good portion of my late teens and early 20s trying to find a way to die without having to actually take the responsibility to kill myself. It's a direct result. I've seen it in so many other people. I've seen it in some of my younger relatives. It's a devastating impact. The hard thing is to change it, to crawl out of that black depression and begin to think of yourself as a human being like other human beings instead of a monster.
What helped you do that?
I'll tell you the truth. I think it was feminism. I began to believe that there was an explanation for what had happened to me, and I came to it largely through a political understanding. I went away to college and somebody talked to me about Marx and showed me, you should be a communist. They said you're working class. Well, I'm not much good at that because communists need to do what they're told. But I started reading and trying to study. Why is it that these things happen and why is it that everybody especially believe that incest and violence happens to poor and working class kids? And I lucked into a study group, a feminist study group. And all of a sudden, it was bigger. It wasn't just that we were poor. It was because I was a girl child and because girl children in my family are taught to endure and survive and not to fight back. And that began to let me be angry. It began to let me believe that I wasn't this monster that deserved what had happened to her, but somebody who had fallen under somebody else's madness.
You did something that it sounds like nobody else in your family had done before. You left home. You went someplace else. You tried to have a life different from the lives you had seen around you. How did you make that move?
Oh, I did something. I did a number of things nobody else in my family had done before. I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school, the first person to go to college. There have been two since. And I have come of an enormous family. It's just that... Both of my sisters dropped out of high school in the 9th and 10th grade. It's just not something that we were given the idea that we could do. But a lot of it had to do with my mother. My mother believed that I was this incredibly special person, that I was brilliant. She thought that I was just amazing. So when I was 5 or 6 years old, she started getting me books, and she started saving money to send me to school. She would put quarters in a tip jar. She did it my entire childhood. The point I went to college, she had almost $200, and she'd been saving for more than 10 years.
Wow.
It wasn't exactly a life in which you could keep money.
Yeah.
But that, when you're, if you make that decision with my mother's encouragement, believing that I was different, a lot of other things come along. The poor get these funny kinds of encouragements that or kind of backhanded encouragement. I mean, it's true. I was I got my glasses from the Lions Club when I was 7 years old. That's how I finally got glasses. I got scholarships to college that were largely based on the fact that we were very poor. So you get those Kiwanis Club awards. Now, those things are marvelous, and it's really wonderful, and you desperately need the money. But, Lord, they make you feel like such a, like an animal, like a startling and surprising animal.
Why? So,
because, of course, you're the special one. You're like the freak amongst this family of trash. And somehow everything you do becomes a reproach to the rest of your family. The fact that I was so bright and won so many prizes and awards and things drove me away from my family. I didn't have any choice about leaving. I didn't know how to talk to them after a while. The hard part was going back.
Right. So something else that set you apart from your family and probably from a lot of people who you knew growing up is that you're a lesbian.
Ah, yes.
How old were you when you figured that out?
I think it was about 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't entirely sure all of what it meant. I just knew that I didn't have any of the same desires that everybody else around me. I wasn't much interested in boys or the whole cycle that you get into of getting boyfriends and doing that whole thing. But I was madly, passionately in love with the little girl down the street. And I was always in love with the little girl down the street, no matter what little girl it was or where we were. I don't think there was a day in my adolescence that I was not madly in love with somebody, and she was always female.
Now, when you were young, things were much less in the open about homosexuality than now. And
yeah,
I think
it's a bit scary.
People who were gay and lesbian were really encouraged to think of themselves as sick and perverted. Coming from a kind of background where you were already really worried and really guilty about who you were and why your stepfather was abusing you, thinking that you liked girls probably or might
it
have
made it
brought
more
on...
complicated.
Yeah, right.
I began to think or worry that people would think that I loved girls because my stepfather had raped me. It was one of the...
Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are thinking that right now, frankly.
Yeah, almost everyone that I've ever talked to says, well, that's it, that's why. But I don't believe it. I believe that my lesbianism has been a source of energy and power in my life. It's almost as if, oh, you must hate men because he did these terrible things to you. That's why you love women. But I don't think of it that way. I don't love women because I hate men. I don't even particularly hate men. I happen to love women. And lust is a little bit more basic than running away, you know?
No, there's a scene in your novel where the sheriff comes after an incident of abuse to talk to the girl. And mm-hmm. she looks at him and she thinks, you're my stepfather.
Yeah.
And she looks at a lot of men in positions of authority and just sees them as, you know, her stepfather in a uniform.
Yeah. For a long time, that's how I thought. And I think that power over dynamic is a big part of authoritarian men. But the thing I have also learned is that it's not the case for all men. It would be so simple. You know, the tempting thing about that kind of analysis is if you said, aha, the problem must be in that Y chromosome will just get it out. But that's not it. I've learned that there are authoritarian, abusive women. what it is that power over the weak that's the problem. And that's something you can't explain away easily by sex or gender.
Well, Dorothy Allison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dorothy Allison's novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, just came out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, viruses. One Nobel laureate called them the single biggest threat to man's continued dominance on the planet. We talk with medical writer Robin Marantz Hennig, author of a new book about the frontiers of viral research. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Reachin', the debut album by the hip-hop group Diggable Planets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Starting in a week, Russian planes will join the operation to airdrop relief supplies into besieged areas of Bosnia. Russian and U.S. military officials made this announcement in Moscow today. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
The Russian planes will fly out of the Rhein-Main NATO airbase near Frankfurt, Germany. Russian pilots will fly two transport jets to drop 260 tons of food and medical supplies. The operation involving the Russians is scheduled to last 2 weeks. It is unusual for Russian Air Force jets to use a NATO base. U.S. officials placed certain restrictions on the Russians. The details were not disclosed. The Americans and Russians are still negotiating who will pay for the Russian participation. It's expected that the Russians will follow the same guidelines for the airdrops that the Americans have been using. The locations for delivering aid will be determined by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
President Clinton says the U.S. and other nations are considering tighter sanctions against Serbia. Mr. Clinton said today he also thinks that there are other economic steps that can be taken, but this must be done in cooperation with other countries, and also in concern over Russia's long-standing ties to Serbia. The president says he also does not want to involve this country in a situation that will be difficult to get out of. In Bosnia, Serbian forces have launched new attacks, even as U.S. airdrops of food and medicine are underway. Both the U.S. and the U.N. have been harshly criticized by a leading human rights group for allegedly ignoring abuses being committed in Somalia. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The U.S.-based human rights group Africa Watch today criticized the United States and the United Nations for its dealings with Somali warlords, claiming their approach is given thuggish leaders and unsavory and murderous characters a legitimacy they do not deserve. In a 28-page report on the situation in Somalia, Africa Watch also applauded the U.S.-led Operation Restore Hope. The group says the military intervention had reversed the widespread famine that devastated the country. However, Africa Watch said the intervention had not gone far enough in disarming Somali warlords. American military commanders in Somalia have stressed cooperation with local warlords to gain their participation in removing heavy weapons from areas where famine relief has been delivered. But two of the warlords, Colonel Omar Jess and his main rival, Mohamed Said Hirsi, also known as Morgan, have been accused of widespread atrocities in the southern Somali town of Kismayu. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 5.5 points to close at 3,404.58 on volume of 247 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. One federal law enforcement official says that some people considered key in the investigation of the World Trade Center bombing in New York have disappeared and may have left the country. The official told the Associated Press it's felt that other people are involved in the bombing, in addition to the suspect arraigned last night and who is now being held without bail. Another man was arrested yesterday for allegedly striking FBI agents searching his apartment in connection with the bombing. At the World Trade Center today, investigators and repair crews observed a moment of silence at 12:18 this afternoon, 1 week after the bombing that killed at least 5 people and injured more than 1,000 others. A federal court in Cleveland today ruled that a hazardous waste incinerator in East Liverpool, Ohio, may begin limited testing. Environmentalists and people living near the site have tried to block the startup of the incinerator. From member station WCPN in Cleveland, Joe Smith reports.
The environmental group Greenpeace and some residents near the plant charged in their suit that testing of the facility presents an imminent health hazard to the community. In today's decision, U.S. District Judge Ann Aldridge will allow Waste Technology Industries to go ahead with an 8-day test burn, but is blocking the facility from going into what's called limited commercial operation. Normally, a waste incinerator is allowed to conduct some burning while awaiting test results. That could take a year. This means WTI could begin testing immediately, but would have to wait for the final test results before beginning full operations. A spokesman for WTI says the company will not make any comments until lawyers can go over the decision. A Greenpeace lawyer says he's not totally pleased with today's ruling, but says it's too early to say if the group will appeal. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Smith in Cleveland.
President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin have picked Vancouver as the site of their first summit. Vancouver is the third largest city in Canada. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. As far as the virus is concerned, we human beings are just a handy way to reproduce. That's one unpleasant observation in a new book about viral research called A Dancing Matrix. The book is by medical writer Robin Marantz Hennig. AIDS has increased our fears about what new viruses are out there. But Hennig says emerging viruses aren't necessarily new. They're usually just new to the region or the species.
We usually think of something new as being more like the Andromeda strain, you know, something that fell from space and that's some new mutant that maybe some scientist did deliberately to infect a population he didn't like. But in fact, the viruses that will threaten us in the future are out there right now, sort of peacefully cohabitating in the environment that they currently are existing in. And what will be different about them, what will be threatening, is that they will move to a new population. They'll cross borders. They'll move into a new geography or into a new species. And it will infect a population that has never seen the virus before, and it won't be used to it immunologically. It won't be able to fight it in the way that the coexisting population had been able to.
Why are viruses so much harder to kill than bacteria?
They're much more of a parasite than bacteria is. A bacterium is actually a living thing that can reproduce on its own and then can do all the things that you think a life form needs to do. A virus can't do anything on its own. The only way that it can reproduce is by getting into a cell and sort of tricking the cell's reproductive machinery into making more viruses instead of making more cells. So that means that the virus is very intimately connected with the workings of a healthy cell. So to find something that will kill a virus, we also are likely to damage the cell itself. It's just much harder to come up with an antiviral agent as a result of that.
What are some of the things that you learned about the characteristics of HIV, the AIDS virus?
Well, I guess something that I learned in doing the book that I didn't realize before is that it's basically, now at least, a chronic illness, so that somebody can carry HIV for many years, 10 years, sometimes even more, and can be passing it on during all that time. You know, at first you look at it and you think, well, here is this virus that's totally dependent on its host to keep it alive, to reproduce for it and to keep it alive. How can it be so uniformly lethal? Because once it kills its host, it has to die out too. Well, the brilliance of HIV, if you can anthropomorphize like that, is that it hides for such a long time and has this long chronic period, this long latent period, so that the carrier feels healthy enough to transmit it, and there's many opportunities for transmission. And so then the virus does just fine at multiplying in somebody else's body before the original carrier gets too sick to pass it on.
What are some of the characteristics of HIV that have made it a virus that is spread through body fluids but not spread through coughs and sneezes? It's not an airborne virus.
Well, viruses seem to have a propensity towards going to a particular kind of cell. This is something called tropism. So some viruses go into the lung and become sort of carried on the droplets that come out of the lung when you cough. This is how, you know, influenza is spread, how measles is spread. because they are tropic to the respiratory system. HIV is tropic to the immune system and the blood and blood cells, so that that's the only way that it can be transmitted. It hasn't developed the capacity to infect the respiratory system.
You raise a question in your book about whether viruses can cause chronic diseases and whether there can be conditions that a lot of people have that nobody has connected yet to a virus, mm-hmm. but might actually be caused by a virus. What kinds of conditions were you thinking about when you wrote that? What kinds of conditions are being questioned now?
Well, there are some big surprises. There are some chronic conditions that people never think have anything to do with an infectious disease that have been sort of associated in some studies with certain viruses. For example, heart conditions, atherosclerosis, the buildup of plaque in the arteries, seems to be connected with cytomegalovirus, CMV. Basically all that people know right now is that people or animals who have CMV infection seem to be more prone to developing plaque buildup in their arteries. And I don't know exactly what can be made of this kind of a finding. You know, CMV, for example, is a ubiquitous virus. Almost everybody's exposed to it by the time they become adults, so that a cause and effect relationship will be very difficult to prove. But if somehow you can develop a vaccine against CMV so that you get antibodies and don't really need, you know, can't really get exposure to the virus in a way that can damage your blood vessels, that would be so wonderful to be able to eliminate that cause of coronary artery disease.
Medical writer Robin Marantz-Hennig is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robin Marantz-Hennig. She's a medical writer who's written a new book about viruses called A Dancing Matrix. Robin, did you get flu shots while researching your book on viruses?
I actually didn't. I was convinced by what I was reading that the protection that you get from a flu shot is limited. If you get a flu shot, and if it does happen to contain protection against the flu virus that we actually are exposed to that year, which is only a 50-50 proposition, that protection is only going to last for about a year. If you allow yourself to get influenza, which is, you know, not fun, but not life-threatening if you're basically healthy, then your immune protection will more likely last 3 or 4 years. The flu virus changes slightly from 1 year to another, which is why people need to get new flu shots every year if they are getting flu shots, but it changes slightly, you know, the changes are small enough that the antibodies that you've built up to last year's flu, if you've built them up naturally, will probably protect you from the slight variation in next year's flu. If you build them up as a result of the flu shot, though, for some reason the antibodies just aren't as robust, and you really have to get the shot again year after year.
How does a vaccine trick a body into creating an immunity to it?
Well, there are different ways that different vaccines work. Some of them will actually contain the virus, either in a killed form. In other words, it doesn't have any of the guts, but it has sort of the outside shell of the virus. Or else they'll contain it in what's called an attenuated form, which is a weakened form. In either case, the virus can't make you sick, but it can make your immune system see something as a foreign intruder and go into action, which is to build up antibodies that fit perfectly against this foreign intruder. That's what your body will do if it gets an actual virus infection, too. But usually, the virus can multiply very, very rapidly, and your antibody response takes several days to really get going. And that's the period during which you get sick. If your antibody response gets going in response to this weakened virus or this killed virus, then the antibodies are sort of there for life, ready for the next onslaught of virus, so that when you get infected for real next time, the antibodies are already there and the virus doesn't have a chance to start replicating in large enough amounts to make you really sick.
Mm-hmm. Why is there so much guesswork involved with creating a flu vaccine each year?
It's hard to know in which direction the flu changes are likely to go. The best that people can do is try to go to the source of our influenza. Every year in China or other countries of Asia, there is an influenza outbreak about 6 months to a year before that same outbreak occurs here. So we've actually got flu watchers who go to Asia and try to track down precisely what kind of virus is infecting the population there, and then rush back to the United States and try to make a vaccine against that precise arrangement of viruses. What happens in Asia, too, is this goes back to what we were talking about before, about what human beings do that set up conditions for new viruses to occur. In Asia, they often farm in a way that puts different species of animals in proximity to each other. And these animals are all capable of harboring a human influenza virus. So you've often got, say, ducks and pigs on the same farm that might be co-infected with the same with different strains of a human influenza virus. Because the flu virus is so easily mutated, because it sort of rearranges itself so easily, if you've got a duck and a pig together, they might take their different human influenza viruses and mix them up, sort of like you're shuffling a deck of cards, and come out with some totally new arrangement that we haven't seen before. That's you know, the beginning of a totally new strain of influenza and the beginning of a pandemic flu. And all the pandemics that we've had in the past seem to have originated in Asia, because that's where these animals cohabitate.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you have to say that's good about viruses?
They are basically, they've been called a piece of bad news wrapped in protein. And certainly when they make you sick, it feels as though there's nothing good about them. But scientists have been able to use viruses almost to domesticate viruses and use them to their own purposes. The most dramatic example is gene therapy, where basically what they do is take a virus which has a brilliant way of getting inside of a particular cell, and instead of having the virus genes inside of it, they strip out the virus gene so that the virus itself is harmless, and put in whatever human gene is desired to get into that cell, a gene carrying a particular enzyme that an individual might be lacking, or a gene carrying a tumor-fighting protein that a cancer patient might need. And then they infuse that virus back into the patient, and the virus actually helps the gene get to the spot where it's supposed to be. So to that extent, viruses can sort of be harnessed in a way, and their own tricks can be used to humans' benefits.
You raise a disturbing possibility in the book, and I'm curious how widespread fear of this is in the scientific community, that now that we have several conditions that incapacitate the immune system, including AIDS, and including temporarily people who get organ transplants because the immune system is suppressed so that the body doesn't reject the new organ, why are we creating circumstances that are conducive to viruses mutating in a way that might be really dangerous to us in the future?
Yeah, there are several scientists who are concerned about that, who are worried that you'll, for example, insert a kidney into an individual, and then to keep the person from rejecting the kidney, you have to give them immune suppressant drugs, and yet the kidney is carrying some ostensibly harmless virus like cytomegalovirus that isn't even tested for because everybody's got it. But once you've got the transplant recipient who is immune suppressed, that cytomegalovirus can indeed start multiplying in a way that's sort of abnormal because it's not in a normal human body, and it can mutate and can create a new variant of cytomegalovirus that isn't harmless anymore. There are some scientists who are rather concerned about that. And then there's a new concern that isn't even in the book because it's too recent. When we start transplanting animal organs into human beings, which is happening in just, you know, very, very few cases now, but if that were to become more common, then we'd be actually putting in to an immunocompromised person, because we've given him those immune suppressant drugs, an animal virus. And who knows what the result of that could be.
When you were researching viruses, did you start imagining viruses everywhere?
I started to get a little nervous about what it was that we could do to protect ourselves. It seemed as though everything that humans did had some sort of a viral impact, and we weren't really taking it into account. You know, we know that progress has an environmental cost, but I don't think people had realized that it also has a public health cost. The only thing that saved me from getting really frantic was thinking that there are now, for the first time, some scientists who are also thinking along these lines and who are trying to make some sort of a coordinated effort to stay one step ahead of whatever new virus is likely to come along the pike. I don't think that we'll be quite as surprised by the next sudden new epidemic as we were about the AIDS epidemic. I think that people's level of suspicion has been raised, and that if we see just a few new cases of something that can't quite be explained, that I hope that some international effort will be mounted to try to track down its cause more quickly than we did the last time.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robin Morantz-Hennig is the author of the new book, A Dancing Matrix, Voyages Along the Viral Frontier. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from Waco, Texas, and on the World Trade Center on All Things Considered?
We'll have updates on both situations, Terry. John Burnett has a story from Texas on how so much firepower got into that Waco compound, and we'll talk to an experienced hostage negotiator about what they're trying to do there. The World Trade Center will have an update from New York, and we'll also talk to somebody about the Islamic fundamentalists, the group that the person who's been arrested has been identified with. We're also seeing some shape to Bill Clinton's health care proposal. We'll have a story on that, and this is the 40th anniversary of Stalin's death.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. About a year ago, pop music audiences became aware of a new wave of hip-hop acts that were expanding the subject matter and vocabulary of rap music, performers like Arrested Development, Mi Fi Mi, and Basshead. The latest of these groups is a widely hailed trio called Diggable Planets. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their debut album, Reachin', A New Refutation of Time and Space.
It was 8:49 on a beautiful ninth day of July. There was not a cloud to speak of, so the orange sun hung lonely in the sky. I lay prone in my cabbie home, thinking of fine nappy Jackie and his jazz cat's horn, sliding in a tape of Bird on Verb when suddenly rang my phone. Hey, butterfly, the voice said, slip on some duds, comb out your fro, and slide on down to my pad. The vibe here is very pleasant, and I truly request your presence. A problem of great magnitude has arose, and as we speak, it grows. Damn, what could it be?
The three young singer-rapper-songwriters who make up Diggable Planets, they go by the names Butterfly, Ladybug, and Doodlebug, are the 90s version of 50s beatniks. They're at home with hip-hop, and they take care to salute the rock and roll innovations of Jimi Hendrix, but the bedrock source of their music lies in Beat Generation poetry. On this album, Diggable Planets invoke Charlie Parker in their lyrics, and various tunes sample riffs from Sonny Rollins and Art Blakey in the Jazz Messengers. With the delight and nerve of smart young artists, they claim all of African-American pop music as their own, giving it a bohemian spin.
Like the breeze float straight out of our lids. Them, they got boo bodies, hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us, floor rush when they DJ booming classics. You dig the crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He tucks the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep, fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why's it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When Butterfly rocked the light, new sway boomers. What about a cut? We push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh in fact since they started saying Audi? Cause funk's made fat from right beneath my hood. The pooba of the styles like Miles. Like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock, but I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that.
Within just a few weeks of the release of this album, Diggable Planets is already very popular, very media pervasive. Heavy radio airplay and video, a glittering 4-star review in Rolling Stone, a guest appearance with David Letterman, who referred to them as Diggable Plants. I don't hear much that's original in this group. Rambling, discursive poetry read over cool jazz riffs may be happening stuff now, but writers like Jack Kerouac, Leroy Jones, and Allen Ginsberg were doing it 40 years ago. Still, I take the instant success of Diggable Planets as a measure of a particular sort of pop desire right now, the yearning of large multi-ethnic audiences to connect with each other, to agree that we share a culture that, no matter which way you bend and shape it, is still like a happening groove, man.
Boogie, job, and rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, a mod play where Izzy, where I'm from. Where I'm from, it be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beats by the pack. Where I'm from, nappy hair is life. We be reading Marx where I'm from. The kids be rocking clocks where I'm from. You turn around your cap, you talk over a beat. And dig some sounds booming out of Jeep where I'm from. Cocoons hide the youth, swing units 100 proof. You want some beef?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
It's hip, what's hip, when hip is just the norm. Cause planets pledge allegiance to the funk in all its forms. The kinks, the dance, the prints on all the shirts. My grandmother told my mother it's Africa at work. On vibes, we freak, them universal beats. You find it at the spot, you hit it ends of every week. We twist, exist, to spin the maddest hits. Here funk is our neighbor, so we paid her a visit. The lip we sit can house the nine.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the dilemmas of women who are Catholic and feminist. We talk with Mary Jo Weaver. Her new book examines how some women are trying to reform the church from within, while others are creating new alternatives. Also, Mary Frances Berry on the politics of motherhood. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.